Molly Hilly was the musical director of the Unitarian Church on 8th Street here in Los Angeles for 50 years. And he was the artistic director. And this was during the time when at that church, the balcony was full because it became a hideout and a refuge and a gathering place for the blacklisted artists of Los Angeles during the 50s. And they would go there and they'd do shows and they would entertain each other as they had been entertaining the entire country, but were no longer allowed to put their names on their work, or to, in many cases, even do their work because they were labeled as communists or fellow travelers. Molly Hilly published The People's Songbook, which is a very popular songbook from that era. One time, Molly Hilly was in New York, in Harlem, with Paul Robeson. And Paul Robeson walked out on the street, Molly behind him, and all of a sudden, of course, a crowd began to gather, and people began to come from all around until the whole street was full of people, and they began to shout, "Sing for us, sing for us." And Paul Robeson said, "Well, how can I? I don't have a piano." You know. And a whole bunch of fellas, three guys, ran up three stories of steps, picked up a piano, and carried it back down to the street and set it down next to Paul Robeson. And Molly Hilly sat down and played, and Paul Robeson sang on the streets of Harlem that day.
Beck, L.A. Public Work Improvisational Theater, the artistic director, talking about Paul Robeson singing on the streets of Harlem. Welcome to the Qumran Report. May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. My name is Melvin Ishmael Johnson, coming at you from Skid Row Studios. Our call-in number is 800-893-9562. Listen to us live, or you can download our show and any past show by Googling in skidrow.la. and hit Qumran Report. We opened the show with Lee Beck talking about Paul Robeson singing on the streets of Harlem. And there's a theater company right here in Los Angeles named in honor of Paul Robeson, the Roby Theater Company. And they're doing a great play, Bronzeville, written by Tim Taiyama and Aaron Woodfolk, and directed by Ben Guillory. This is the last weekend where there will be six performances, Thursday and Friday, July the 18th and 19th at 8 o'clock p.m., and Saturday and Sunday, July the 20th and 21st at 3 o'clock p.m. and 8 o'clock p.m. at the Los Angeles Theater Center, located at 514 South Spring Street, L.A. 90013. Now, I'm delighted to have with us in the studio Cecilia Antoinette, who plays the role of Mama Janie in the play Bronzeville. She's going to talk about women's in the theater and her role in Bronzeville. Also sitting in is writer-poet Michelle Autry, actor, community activist Lee Shaw, and Bobby Buck sitting in the studio with us. CC, Michelle, Lee, Bobby, welcome to the Qumran Report.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thank you.
Cecilia Antoinette have appeared on Broadway in Lincoln Center Theater, Mule Bone, and in numerous off-Broadway regional and international theaters. On TV, Cecilia have appeared in Weeds, Two Broken Girls, Mad Men's, Girlfriends, Desperate Housewife, Brothers and Sisters, Crossing Jordan, Law and Order, The Office, Chris Rock Show, Jimmy Kimmel Live. In film, she can be seen in Yes Man, starring Jim Carrey, Dance Food, directed by Cedric the Entertainer, and she was one of the first female guest hosts of Amateur Night at the Apollo. As a writer and spoken word artist, CeCe has published and produced Brown Gals Rising, Just As I Am, and Jukebox Poetry. She is the founding artistic director of Plumbing Production, P-L-U-M-E, I-N-G Production. CC, welcome to the Coon Round Report.
Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Boy, oh boy, you did your homework. I was kind of impressed with that bio. Yes. I sound like a working actress, huh?
Now, CC, can you tell us, how did you first get out here to Los Angeles, and then how did you get into acting and writing?
Okay. Of course, you know, the quick flip answer is I took a plane. But no, I spent my adult life in New York City. So the same Harlem that Paul Robeson walked, I walked. I lived in Harlem for about 8 years on 133rd Street, right there at 7th Avenue. It's called Adam Clayton Powell Jr. Boulevard now. So, you know, they changed a lot of the avenue names from numbers to names. So I know all those places. And right across the street from me was a place that used to be called Small's Paradise. It's mm-hmm. not there anymore. It might be there now because it's been about 7 years since I've been out here in L.A. So that's kind of what I wanted to do more in TV and film in New York. You know, you do a lot of theater. And like you say, I've done regional theater. I've done international theater. I've done Broadway. And I wanted to do a little bit more TV and film, and the best place to do that was Los Angeles.
Los Angeles. Can you talk about the status of African-American women in the theater? Can you give me your thoughts
okay.
on that?
Now, is that African-American women in theater? Is that African-American women in entertainment?
In theater.
Okay, in theater specifically.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you want my personal point of view?
Yes.
Okay. Theater actually sometimes offers, in some ways, it offers more vibrant opportunities for African American women and actually for African American actors because theater, you know, plays generally have parts that are meatier, you know, that you can sink your teeth into. Many of them are more, I'm going to use the word true to life, because a play is going to be either about a period or a time or a family, whereas sometimes in TV and film, you'll get some parts, but like I'm a working actress doing guest starring, co-starring parts. So to get the supporting parts, to get the lead parts in TV and film is, they're there and they're coming, and there are lots of African-Americans who are moving up the ranks and doing things in those areas. Mm-hmm. In theater, you get to, it really is a strange little dichotomy there. On one hand, you want to say, I'd like to see more theater, more of our stories being told. On the other hand, when you look at it and you say, well, then there are quite a few of them that are being told, especially when you look at TV, films, and you see the number of people, the number of television shows that go into production, the number of films that go into the production, and the number of us that are involved in them. So.
Mm-hmm. What are your experience with female playwrights and female directors out here in L.A.? Is there seem to be quite a few of them? Is it opening up for the female playwright and the female director?
I too am a writer. I am a writer, director, mm-hmm. Actress. You know, when you come to L.A., one of the things that someone told me, and I didn't quite understand it. In New York, it's quite acceptable to be hyphenate. You know, what do? Well, I write, I direct, I act, I play pool, I play basketball on the side. You know, whatever it is you do, it's okay to do that as long as you do it well. Mm-hmm. So in L.A., though, you kind of have to lead with one thing. Mm-hmm. So you kind of have to tell people, well, I am an actress. So, you know, and for me, I lead with that. But mm-hmm. I'm my history in directing, I'm one of Lincoln Center Theater Directors Lab. And the year that I was involved, it's an international collective. Mm-hmm. We studied theater and directing from South Africa to France to Russia. So it's, you know, I have a pretty strong directing background in New York. Here in L.A., there are some really good female directors. L.A.'s kind of funny in that what you have here is you have a lot of little theaters. You know, you've got 20-seat theaters, 30-seat theaters, 50, 40, you know what I mean? And all the way up to 99, like the Roby is a 99-seat theater for all practical purposes. Those are called what we call equity waivers. So then you've got the larger theaters, the theaters that are larger than 99 seats are the ones that are more difficult for directors to break into. I'm sorry, that's the phone, and, you know, I was sending out messages for people to call into the show.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's what that is. Let me turn that off.
Okay.
So it's more difficult to break into the larger houses, but the smaller houses, female directors are really doing their thing. And I just find I'm a proactive person. I believe in being proactive. You write the script. You want to tell a story, write the story, you know. If you want to be a director, you know, find the piece that you can direct. And that's for men, women, young people, you know, whatever. I'm very proactive in terms of that, and I believe that people ought to be. I don't spend a lot of time complaining.
Yes.
I don't like to cry in my beer. And because I don't like to cry in mine, I don't want anybody else to cry in mine either. You know what I'm saying? So when people come up to me, tell me, oh, woe is me about the plight of, you know, actors and artists, you know, I am not unsympathetic. But I am, I'm going to turn around and I'm going to say, so what are you doing? What are you doing to make that thing happen? What are you doing to create an opportunity for yourself to direct something?
Okay.
And you can direct anything from a church play to, you know, you can go into schools, you know.
Children's play.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. What advice would you give a young person who would like to become an actor coming into the business? They come to you and they want, what advice would you give them?
Stay in school. Learn to read. Learn to read. It sounds so simple, but
did
it's fundamental. Learn to read. And practice reading. You know, read aloud. And I say that because all of this, the script is the thing. If a writer, if you don't have a good script, if you don't have a script, let's start with that. You don't have anything to work on, no matter the director, no matter the actor, the technicians. You don't have anything if you don't have the script. So with a script, learn to read. When young kids are able to read, then they can interpret what is being said, what's actually there on the page. When they're able to interpret it, then they can act. A lot of kids come up to me and they think, you know, because they looking at movies and they see these kids on TV and film, and they think, I can do that. And then you hand them a script, and they are marginal readers.
Okay. Now, what is your process for learning lines?
That's a funny thing. I'm from the true school. You know, when I say true school, a lot of people call it the old school. I don't call it the old school no more. Old school, circle, line, out. Old school, I call it the true school. Why? Because a lot of those lessons that we learned then hold such truth and such merit that no matter what, you can always go back. You can always go back to it. You can always rely on it and trust that it's going to get you where you've got to go. So, you know, in the true school, we learned mnemonics. We learned 30 days at September, April, June, and November. We learned, you know, different little tricks that really helped us to remember things. We learned people's names. As a matter of fact, it was a matter of respect. If somebody walked in the door that you had met before and you didn't remember their name, I don't know, in my house, my mama would have had you for dinner. Well, I was more afraid of my mother than remembering. So it's like, so I do something that's called mnemonics. I do Mnemonics is a system, no matter what it is you do it or how you manipulate it, it helps you to remember names, it helps you to remember numbers, and then it helps you to remember, I won't say lines, it does help you to remember lines, but it helps you to remember the gist of a line. So once you remember the gist, then you go in and then you start doing what is called line cleanup.
So when you get your hand on somebody give you a script and ask you to consider reading a role, the first thing you do is to read the script from the beginning to the end first?
Actually, no, I don't. I have, everybody has their own way, of doing a thing with a script. But honestly, what I do, I read the first sentence and I read, and I turn it over and I read the last sentence.
In the play.
In the play. Or in a book, in a novel, I'll do the same thing. So for me, everything that comes in between has got to get me from the first sentence to the last sentence.
Now, one of the major problems that I see with a lot of actors that I come in contact with is the concept of projection. what can you do to, what are your thoughts on what advice can you give an actor about improving their projection? Because it's important to hear what that actor saying in the theater.
Well, you've got two things going on here, and this is my observation. Again, the true school kids, you know, who know theater, there's projection is not a problem. How to project to that back row, because that's part of the training. The new kids are kind of TV and film oriented, so projection is not so, because they can mic a room, they can light a room, and you can be right next to a person and you don't have to project. So they're kind of two different trainings. So when you have a person who's from one training going into another arena, then they've got to use some skills that if they don't have them, they've got to learn them and figure out how to make that happen.
What is the difference in working as an actress in the theater and in film?
The difference, honestly, is money. Bottom line, money. That I say that. That may sound okay. And this is why young people are drawn to it, because there's so much money to be made in TV and film. You can make money so many different ways, and there's something called residual. When you work one day and you get a line in something, you're going to get paid for doing that line over and over and over again. Whereas with theater, especially here in Los Angeles, well, actually theater anywhere, you get paid for a show you do that day, and once you get that check, you've been paid. So with young people, it's about money. What's the difference?
How about the artistic approach? I'm interested, you know, is there a difference in the way that they approach the craft when you're performing a role in television or the film, or as opposed to the theater, or you think it's similar or the same?
It really is about motivation. And again, if you're motivated, if money is your motivation, then you're going to have a particular range of results. If art is your motivation, you're going to have a particular range of results. I hope I'm making some sense.
Oh, yeah, because I consider a real artist is where the number one thing is art is their motivation.
It's creating something that...
Yeah, the commercial
even if they're playing a character that is a dark or evil or something, there's an art to that. You know, if you want to go in, you've got to find the humanity, you know, for that character, and that's craft. That's you know, when you look at some of these new films that are coming up, one of the reasons the blockbusters that we really like, the people, the villains and the good guys have an artistry that we just we can't take our eyes off.
Now, who in the theater history influenced you the most? I know probably more than one individual, if you can talk about a few that influenced your style or what you like to do in the theater? Any other historical characters?
I am a historian, really. I love history. I love biographies. I have a show called The Awe Series, African-American Women of Endeavors. It's performance vignettes that I do in libraries and schools. And I love doing it because I love history. And I think that in teaching young people, you know, teaching by the old way is kind of, kids don't gravitate to that. But if you bring it to them, kind of like Bronzeville, you know, you bring it to them in a history form and they get it, they remember it. And it's with them for the rest of their lives. My mother was an actress in Dallas, Texas. So the auditorium in my mother's name is Naomi Bruton, and the main auditorium at the Black Academy of Arts and Letters in Dallas is named and dedicated to my mother. So I would say that my mother was one of my primary influences. And then you probably have heard of this actress Irma P. Hall. Irma came through Dallas and cut her teeth in Dallas. She played Big Mom in Soul Food and Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, A Lesson Before Dying. She has a history, really, that's stellar. And then I'd have to say, of course, you know, the world-class Ruby Dee, Ms. Ruby Dee and Ossie Davis. My life track has crossed theirs in so many ways throughout my history and my career. Guy Davis, their son, even played my son in one of the first plays that I did in New York in Harlem.
For us to play. Yeah.
It was called Light in the Cellar. Gertrude Jeanette, the Hatley players in New York City. There's a woman here in L.A., B.B. Smith, played my daughter. B.B., you'll see, she does commercials and a lot of TV and stuff. Her husband... It was a writer for CBS for Girlfriends and a lot of different shows. So,
what do you think is the biggest challenge facing African American women in the theater? What's the biggest challenge you think?
The number of roles.
Okay.
There's a lot of us out there, and the number of roles are not so many.
Now, is that the term that you think you should have more female playwrights, more female writers, writing roles for the actors?
Well, there are female writers, but I don't. It doesn't have to necessarily be female writers. I am a very strong proponent of the feminine divine. That's my whole thing. Because I do feel on the planet that I think part of the problem that the reason the planet is in the place where it is that the feminine divine has been so inverted and disrespected that the masculine divine now does not actually know what to do with itself or the planet because it has kind of shifted and moved the feminine divine to a place where now it's like, okay, now what do I do? Okay. I know that's controversial.
Okay. But let's talk about Bronzeville for a while. Can you talk about Bronzeville and your role in the play Mama Janie?
Mama Janie.
Can you talk about that a while?
Mama Janie.
Yeah.
Bronzeville.
First of all, you was in the original.
Yes.
From you're the one that created the role of Mama Jane.
Yes.
Talk about the experience.
It was a fabulous experience, and as an actor, you know, we love the opportunity. I do. I love creating and originating a role, or even when I see a role that I think is tremendous that I've seen others do, It's the artist in me that's looking at that and going, that's good. Ooh, that's good. Ooh, that's good. Now, what would I do with that? That's always the question that's rolling around in the back of your head. Now, what would I do with that? You know, I look at a lot of August Wilson's work, and we love that. And you think to yourself, ooh, you know, what would I do with that? You know, I did Fences in New Rochelle, which is the Davis home in New York, and the reviewers talked about the they reviewed the play, and they said, Rose, my Rose was so young. They said, but this actress just really, you know, took it and did something with it that that they weren't quite expecting. So with Bronzeville, it is 1942, Los Angeles, and it's a story that I did not know prior to getting involved with Bronzeville. I knew that the Japanese were interred in internment camps. I did not know that Los Angeles, Little Tokyo was vacated, and African-Americans from the South moved into those areas. I did not know that. I did not know that there was something called Bronzeville. I had heard of Bronzeville in Chicago, but I did not know of Bronzeville in Los Angeles, and that was 2009. So just that recently, when we started doing it, I'm like going, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. So, you know, the historian and the biography in me just really started digging further into it to find out, wow.
Well, let me ask you this, because you guys have an outstanding cast. And in a minute ago, I'm going to have in a few minutes, I'm going to have our other two guests ask you a question, because they have seen Bronzeville. I know they're getting a question together in their head.
Okay.
But have the process changed? I think this is about the third time around for this production. Have the process changed from the first time to the second time to the third time? In other words, are you bringing something different from these other?
Yes,
can you talk about that a little?
The process is the same. From, again, going to the true school, the process is the same. So what you have to do, and this is what I told Ben when we had a conversation when he invited me to reprise this role.
The director, Ben Guillory.
I said, Ben, you know, let me think on this. Let me sleep on this, because if I felt I could bring something new and interesting and different, then I wanted in. If I didn't feel that I could have, then I would have said thank you very much and gone to see someone else do something. As I started, I'm Buddhist, by the way, and well, that's one of the concepts that comes up in the play. As I started going into my my meditation about it, I found out that it's like I was guided to take
to
this
do the wrong. Mm-hmm.
And go further. Mm-hmm. So, and that's what we did, and all of us, those of us who were reprising our roles, we all dug in and you know, looking for new gold, you know, just looking for new gold, and we're finding it.
Yes, an amazing process to watch this very talented cast bring those characters to life. Now, at this time, I'm going to ask you to do a monologue.
Let's talk with the others before.
Before you get to the monologue.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, let's take a question from, let's take Michelle saw the play on opening night. Do you have a question for Mama Janie?
Oh, well, you know, I have to first of all say, look, everybody that hasn't seen Bronzeville needs to see it just for education, edutainment. You have to see this film. It brings Black and Japanese culture. It brings culture together, period. Because, you know, I had no idea before I saw another play a few years ago just how similar, you know, some of the experiences that we've had. And I just have to encourage you, please go see this play. It's amazing. And Mama Jane, I didn't know this was her.
Couldn't recognize her.
She was so fabulous. I was like, oh my goodness, this woman is such an incredible star. Her light, her energy is so beautiful. And the way she creates and recreates this character, I mean, as an artist, is just so beautiful. All of the artists, Ben Guillory, behind the scenes, Melvin Ishmael.
And the stage manager, John Freely Jr.
And I tell you, we couldn't do this show without the things
everybody
that
comes here. It is such a... All the
everybody brings their A-game.
Yes. It is just, please, everybody, you have to go see this before it's finished. But I was actually speaking with CeCe before we started. This is really very interesting to me. because I still deal with this field and house nigga. You know, I'm sorry to say the N-word, Negro.
Oh, shucks. I'm sorry, field and house
because this is a quality production. Forgive me, Melvin.
Oh, sure.
I got too much.
No limits.
I've been downtown on Skid Row too long. Yeah.
Let me ask, go ahead, because I want to move to Lee.
Okay, very, very quickly, because one of the sons wanted to sell out the Japanese young man because he thought it was the right thing to do in his heart, or the grandson. And then everyone, because you had seen your uncle lynched, burned to death by some white Southerners, was like, no, we cannot, even though it's against the law, we cannot, we know our history. And I want to know, what were your personal feelings in dealing with that? And relative to even today with, say, counterintelligence versus some activists in our black community? Mm-hmm.
That's a good question. For Mama Janie, it's a little heartbreaking without talking the play out, but in that moment when I know that he has dropped a dime, as they say, And this young kid gets taken away. It's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking because there's a note in the music. There's a note that plays, boom. Mm-hmm. And Mama Janie knows that there's no good end that's gonna come from this. You know, there's no good end that's gonna come from this. And that note just kind of, for me, is my heartbeat. And it just kind of goes, boom, and it kind of sets me up for a little bit later, you know, for the real heartbreak.
And we're going to do the monologue in a minute. Because let me get a question in with Lee so we can move right along. There's a couple of things I want to get in before our time run out. Lee, you have a question for CC.
Y'all probably didn't mostly asked all the questions I was going to ask. But anyway... Yeah. Being the wise one in the family and the one who basically protects the family, right? Your character. When you were there planting, telling the young guy, young Japanese, and he was talking about the tomatoes and the eggplants.
Mm-hmm.
And you said that about the soil.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered, I said, now, is she from the South, or did she see somebody else do that? You know, you are from the South.
I'm born and raised in Dallas, Texas, and keep going.
And that character, how did you get into it like that?
Oh my, that's a fabulous question, because mm-hmm. the garden is when I say this and you remember the play and your memory is very specific, ask him what he does for memory.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Everybody in the play, think about this, has their little world.
Yeah.
You know, once they move into the house, they all kind of stake out their little da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And the only place Mama Janie's world becomes that garden. Mm-hmm. So Jody and Alice have taken over the house. You know, the grandson has the club.
Yeah.
Princess is looking for her place in the world, but mm-hmm. that garden, my grandmother, who's 107 years old, Princella Hartman, Granny, this is a shout out to you,
mm-hmm.
has a green thumb. She could grow anything.
Mm.
And one of the things she would do when she'd get out in that garden, she would just be in her own world. And one of the things she always told us, she said, no matter where you live, you know, when I was moving to New York, she said, you find your place. And I remember this. I remember it now, but I forgot and then remembered. She said, wherever you go, find your place to create your little garden. Mm-hmm. She said, it'll heal you, and it'll make you feel better.
Uh-huh.
Of course, then when you get to New York, you know, on the pavement, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and then I must have been in New York years, and it's like, you know, and you get that kind of out-of-sorts kind of thing going,
uh-huh.
and I started doing my indoor plants,
uh-huh.
and so now I have a green thumb with my indoor plants, but the garden is essentially that. It is... that life and that life force. And one of the things that the kid says in the beginning when he asks about eggplant and tomatoes, he says, this is where my father gardened, and I would love to have it, you know, look great for him, and look at how it looks.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell him, no matter how much it die, it'll always come back to life. Then the last, I don't want to say too much about the plant.
Oh,
but,
don't you?
The last scene of the plant, the dad comes in, and the garden is alive, like the kid wanted his dad to walk into.
Yeah, look, let's move into the monologue.
Oh, the monologue.
Yes.
Okay.
Through the setting for the monologue and through the monologue, we're going to move into the performance section of our show. We're winding down the last 20 minutes.
Okay.
Yes.
Let's see. To just kind of set it up, one of the things Michelle Michelle talked about was the son. Mama, the Goodwin family moves to California, and there's Mama Janie, who is well near 90 years old, and the two grandsons, Jody and Felix. Felix is a saxophone player. He loves to play jazz. Jody is a laborer. Jody's married to Alice, and, mm-hmm. and Jody and Alice have a daughter named Princess. Now, Princess Princess is very much in 1942 what we would call spoiled. But then I think I spoiled Felix too. By the time they came to live with me, Jody is a teenager, mm-hmm. And Felix is a young kid. I think there's about a 12-year difference in between there.
Okay.
So just setting it up, just so you understand, the monologue happens when Jody wants to take this little Japanese guy out of the house.
And
that the kid has just told us is his. And so Mama Janie just kind of gets, she's had enough, and she just says, Jody Goodwin, you let that boy go, and you listen to me, goddammit. I said, let that boy go. Now, how could you? After all the times I told you about my Uncle Blue, I told you about him a couple of times when you was just a little girl, but your daddy asked me to stop. Thought it might be too much for you at that age. Well, Uncle Blue was a slave, like me. My mama loved him as much as you could love a man, and Uncle Blue was strong and proud, and he hated being a slave. Even though he's born into it, he knew it wasn't supposed to be that way. He wanted his freedom. One day when he's about 27 years old, he escaped. Told us he's determined to make it up north. Well, he's taken in by these white families that was part of the Underground Railroad. Do you know what that was? That's right. That's right. Well, back in them days, anyone caught helping a slave escape to freedom was severely punished, including white people. It was a big risk, but they took it on. God bless them. Uncle Blue hid in several families' homes on his journey out of Mississippi, heading toward the north. But there was this one family that took him in, and they was feeling the pressure. They thought the neighbors was on to what they was doing, was going to report him to the local marshal, so they reported him first. Well, Uncle Blue was returned to the plantation, and the owner was a mean old son of a... He decided to make a lesson of Uncle Blue. So he made us watch while the overseer tied Uncle Blue to a tree and burned him alive, burned him till he was dead. Now, no one in this family is going to be a part of turning in someone who only wants their freedom. God put us in this situation. God delivered this boy here to us for a reason. And you ain't going to get in the way of God's plan. Now, son, go get you a bath. Go clean yourself up. We're going to get some food in here, and we're going to feed you good. The Goodwins have always been known for feeding people good.
Yes.
Great Mama Janie in the great performance of Bronzeville.
Thank you.
We ask the audience to come out and check out Bronzeville at the Los Angeles Theater Center starting Thursday, running this last weekend for 6 performances. We're going to come back and talk about a little bit more in details. But what I want to do now, I'm going to ask Michelle, she has a favorite piece that she always do. I want to go into it. I want you to do the Bounty. I want to hear the Bounty from the top. You know, give it to us. Give us the Bounty.
Okay, this is Melvin's favorite, and I owe so much to Drama Stage Qumran, Melvin, Ishmael Johnson, and Earlene, who we miss tonight. We love you, Earlene.
Mm-hmm.
I know she's probably out working with the children. All right, here we go. I'm going to just throw. There's a bounty on my head, just like Christopher Dorner. The devil, or should I say white devil, would rather that I was dead. But he put me in jail instead, because I'm a witness. And he gets at least $30,000 a bed, hunted by and for the feds, profits the prison industrial complex, where they be pumping you all full of mind-altering meds that everyone gets religiously, just like our daily bread. Where you be? Brother, sister, is it jail's hell in Hitler's laboratory doing experiments on me? No, it's the United States Penitentiary. Drugs used to turn you into beasts. This I know because it happened to me. For this reason, I try to reach, I try to teach. Who? You. Shots changing you into women. Women into men. Men into women. Don't commit the sin. Don't become gay or lesbian. Try to keep us from being wed and blessed, which could take us from being the tail and make us the head and bless once again. Flooding our neighborhoods with AIDS and crack. Brothers and sisters need to just say no. Tell the devil to just get back and don't lack. Don't be a homo, sisters. You don't need to be a hoe. Your body is a temple, you know. Gamma rays, lasers, tasers, microwave sprays, EMF, ultrasonic high frequency, just like Tuskegee. It was an evil thing what the American government did to me to cover it up. But no one wants to believe you when you sing. At any rate, got to be spirit-led to get ahead and to stay out of the trap set by the New World Order feds. For if they have returned to slavery once again with this Project Plantation penthouse, prison industrial complex, that's the greatest sin. It's an industry, you see, to set traps for brothers look just like you and me. There's a bounty on my head that even you cannot see, where the devil would rather hire my brother, I said hire my brother or sister, to lie on, cheat, beat, rape, capture, and kill me. There's a bounty on my head that leads the police to profile me incessantly, indefinitely, for things I didn't even do. There's a bounty on my head. What they trying to put us on the streets, heaped in poverty, where we can be killed legally by the police? Evil or white supremacy seeks to hurt, beat, break, drug, fix, kill me, change me from good to bad, petite to big, peace to mean, making me a killer only to return to the streets to lie and kill indefinitely. Especially people that look like me. This conspiracy is oh so deep, for the war we wage it spiritually. Watch, fight, and pray always. Do good and be good always. God sees them and he will repay them for all of their sins. To the gangbangers in the street I say, let all violence cease and decease. Let all violence cease and decease. Peace. Peace, please. God knows, only we must learn to discern how not to be the victim no more. Because if you continue to believe a lie, someone must have put it in your mind. You know, you could be bugged, hypnotized, or mesmerized by witchcraft or the evil satanic sublime. To the Mexicans, Latinos, Jews, I say, basta ya and no más. Repent and return to the one and true God, one love. Some say the white man has no melanin-producing pineal, so he cannot feel, only rape, lie, steal, and kill. But many of our brothers and sisters of colors get used, and their souls they lose when they get caught up in the evil trap of the Illuminati. They get paid to get me laid. because of the Masons, the Mafia, Catholic Church, military. They all work in line. They profit while supporting the tokens that they hide in their pockets. They would rather see people like me dead. They say, oh, she's a problem, troublemaker, revolutionary. Like I said, I try to speak the truth instead. My tongue is my weapon. I'm a pedestrian. I'm a vegetarian by choice. I make no contribution to this filth, pollution, and noise. I protect the violent. I protect the innocent women from the violence and children that I can, who seek to delete. They seek to delete. So instead, they put a bounty on my head, and they get cash for every bed that they will feel if they don't make the kill. As they try to make a switch and turn me into a witch. Change good to bad, petite to big, pretty to ugly, spiritual to physical, angel into a demon. That which was chased into a whore, they failed. I got my wings and now I soar. Hear me if I speak, then these powers that be, Illuminati, you could say trilateralists, who are still in authority in this society, will continuously hire the counterintelligence, whoever, to seek frame, put me in jail. I don't care. My soul I will keep because I will speak. I will not fail. Only speak, be, and see the truth. Thank you.
Hey, Michelle Entree performing The Bounty. Now, before we, I want to get back over here with Cece in a minute, but before I do that.
Can we take a moment on the heels of that and say, just hold a moment for Trayvon Martin?
Yeah, let's get that in a minute, because I'm trying to get everything in. I want to acknowledge Bobby here. Give us a little comment right quick before we move on.
Yes, I'm here, and I'm going to be here to support what everybody's doing, because I want people to support what I'm doing with you working in the community. And like I say, we want to reach out to everybody, let everybody know we need to work together. And like what I want to work with using the Barter and Trade Advertisement Network, meets with a referral program where people can get paid to see what we're doing, all the positive work in the community.
Okay, and then we're going to have you guys back here on the 29th with OG. Right, and then on. I'm going to move back over because I want to lead the last 5 minutes. I want to talk about Pastor Jeff in a minute. So we got about 3 more minutes. I'm going to get the comments to Cece. Also, Cece, I want you to not only talk about Trayvon Martin, you get about 3 minutes with that, but talk about your book, Brown Girl Rising. Tell the audience how to get that.
Brown Gals Rising. Mm-hmm. I'll very quickly, you can order it on Amazon.com. Mm-hmm. Cecilia Antoinette, C-E-C-E-L-I-A Antoinette. So it's Amazon.com/ Cecilia Antoinette, C-E-C-E-L-I-A-A-N-T-O-I-N-E-T-T-E. And Brown Gals Rising actually is a 20-year the celebration of 20 years when a production was done, 3 productions actually were done in New York City. So, and there's a bonus video with Phyllis Hyman singing. She came on stage and sang with the group. We Can Change the World, and it's just the book and the DVD is just for me a transformative experience. So,
okay,
yeah.
And then you wanted to say something about Trayvon.
No, I just wanted us to take a moment to say to lift him up and embrace him and. We got a lot of work to do. We've got a lot of work to do. We got some things to fix here.
Yes.
I'm not going to say pretend to have the answer, but we got some things to fix. So I just want your listening audience to know that my heart is in syncopate with what's going on with Trayvon Martin, with that whole because that is the indication of all the things that are going on for all of us.
Okay. Also, let me...
That poem was for Trayvon. I went to the rally yesterday. So for his parents, I mean, God
beautiful.
Help them.
Beautiful. Mm-hmm. Now, last week we lost one of the shining lights from the Skid Row community, former pastor of the Church of the Nazarene, Reverend Jeffrey Thomas, who passed in his hometown of Augusta, Georgia last week. I'd like to play a little short interview I did March 21st, 2013, with the current pastor of the Church of the Nazarene, Reverend Tony Stallworth, about Pastor Jeff and his understanding of the Skid Row community.
Tolerate, you will not fix. If you tolerate everything. If you can come to a place where you can tolerate homelessness, you can tolerate getting your food from the back of the truck when they pull up and feed you. If you can tolerate going to an outdoors bathroom and all that stuff, then you won't fix it. You'd rather stay in that particular condition while you get high and get the drugs.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One more question, and then I'll turn it over to the group. Remember, just before Pastor Jeffrey Thomas left, we did an interview in his office, and one of the things that he said, I think he worked on his PhD, and this was the main theme of it, always stuck in my mind. He said that he thought the problem with Skid Row was what he called the mutual reinforcement of stereotypes. In other words, the people on the outside of Skid Row had certain stereotypes about how Skid Row works, and the people on the inside began to live out these stereotypes. Can you comment on that?
You know, I loved Pastor Jeff. You know, he had his insight was so in depth. You know, it was deep. You know, when you really listened to what he had to say, it was some really and it's true that when you and I run across it all the time. People say, "Tony, where's your church?" "Oh, it's down 6th in San Pedro." "But where's that?" "Skid Row, Los Angeles." "Skid Row?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "Don't worry about it. Said, come on down and visit. Nobody worships like we do. Come on down, because we get into it. You know, we have a wonderful worship, you know, that we do every Sunday. But when they'll tell you, well, yeah, I think I'd like to come. But then all of a sudden, they'll start thinking, well, will my car be safe? Can I walk down the street?" And everybody has a stereotype, you know, from the outside, that is. They've stereotyped the Skid Row community and the people in the community as being violent and being criminals and this and that, and, you know, want to steal everything. And you know, even though we have our pockets of criminal behavior that goes on, the thing about the regular and normal individual is, as long as if you're not hanging out in the dark corners, you're going to be fine. You know, the people in the dark corners, the people that are selling the drugs, the people that are getting high, those are the ones that are in places where you don't want to go anyway. And nobody's going to drag you in there. So I've been, like I said, I've been walking these streets for 17 years. I've walked even into the dark corners and looked to see what's going on. And they all know me, so they don't think anything about it. But the point is I'll tell them, "Well, you know what? If I was you, I wouldn't even mess with that stuff. I said it's bad for you." You know, and just kind of give them a little encouragement like that. But for the most part, the outside individuals, it's true, they have a stereotype about what's going on down here. But if they were to be down here for any amount of time, they would understand that Skid Row people are just like anybody else. They're just like anybody else. And like I said, it's the largest recovery community. Most of them out there, a lot of them out there are in recovery. And so when they come to the church, and we have a karaoke outreach on Wednesday nights where they love to come and sing. We've been doing it for 16 years. And if you haven't seen that, if you get a chance, when you get on your computer, go to homelesskaraoke.com and check it out. It's a blast.
Okay, Pastor Tony, it's Dollar Worth talking about Pastor Jeffrey Thomas, guiding light of the Skid Row community, who would be missed. Pastor Jeffrey Thomas, rest in peace. Mm. Now, next week on the Qumran Report, we will have with us in the studio Pastor Bill talking about his new church in the Skid Row community. I would like to extend a special thank to Cecilia Antoinette for coming into the studio and get out and see this great play, Bronzeville, being performed at the Los Angeles Theater Center now. See this great cast.
514 South Spring Street.
514 South Spring
Thursday,
Street.
Thursday, Friday, Saturday at 8. Beautiful.
Saturday
and Sunday at 3. And Sunday closing performance at 7 p.m.
At 7 p.m. The last six performances. And then I'd like to thank our other in-the-studio guests, Michelle Hartree, that great poem that she read, The Bounding, Lee Shaw, and Bobby Buck, who will be coming out with OG Nim on the 29th to help him at the 3-on-3 basketball league.
Oh, yeah.
Now, please listen to past shows of the Qumran Report on iTunes, Facebook, skidrow.la. Thank you for tuning in to the Qumran Report. And from your host, Melvin Ishmael Johnson, may the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. I leave you with Lee Beck, the artistic director of the Los Angeles Public Work Improvisational Theater Company, talking about Paul Robeson singing on the streets of Harlem.
Molly Hilly was the musical director of the Unitarian Church on 8th Street here in Los Angeles for 50 years. And he was the artistic director, and this was during the time when at that church, the balcony was full because it became a hideout and a refuge and a gathering place for the blacklisted artists of Los Angeles during the 50s. And they would go there and they'd do shows and they would entertain each other as they had been entertaining the entire country, but were no longer allowed to put their names on their work, or to, in many cases, even do their work because they were labeled as communists or fellow travelers. Molly Hilly published The People's Songbook, which is a very popular songbook from that era. One time, Molly Hilly was in New York, in Harlem, with Paul Robeson, and Paul Robeson walked out on the street to Wally behind him, and all of a sudden, of course, a crowd began to gather, and people began to come from all around until the whole street was full of people, and they began to shout, "Sing for us, sing for us," and Paul Robeson said, "Well, how can I? I don't have a piano," you know. And a whole bunch of fellas, three guys, ran up three stories of steps, picked up a piano, and carried it back down to the street and set it down next to Paul Robeson. And Wally Hilly sat down and played, and Paul Robeson sang on the streets of Harlem that day.